quite an introduction. I hardly know how to begin, but I will. It's been said that the only way one can be sure to remain awake during an after-dinner speech is to deliver it. After-luncheon talks are probably not quite that bad, I suppose, but I come to the occasion with a certain amount of anxiety. I am especially nervous because I am, in the catchy phrase of the Columbia Journalism Review, a pallid professor who overqualifies everything he says. The editors of the review made this charge in the course of criticizing our work on the national media elite. Since they also accused me of being Spiro Agnew in disguise, it is quite clear that I represent the worst of all possible worlds. Now, part of their accusation is clearly true. I am a professor and a social scientist. I prefer trying to understand how America has come to be where it is, rather than suggesting what path we are likely to take or should take. And in my remarks, I plan to follow my natural bent and talk about just that. Indeed, if I had had my druthers, I would have preferred to give Irving Kristol's talk on the ideology of the media and to listen to him talk about the media in American democracy, which is more or less the title of my remarks. However, have no fear. I will not speak to you with too many footnotes, and by and large, I shall not use social science jargon. I will summarize the results of the study on which my colleagues and I are working, and draw some modest implications about the future from our work. Now, I'm directing a rather large-scale study of social leadership in the United States. The work of myself and my colleagues on the national media is one part of that study. Our goal is to test certain hypotheses which can be traced back to Max Weber, Joseph Schumpeter, Harold Laswell, and most recently, Daniel Bell and Irving Kristol. I've also been influenced in my thought by my findings on the 1960 student radicals, which have been published, as you know. Now, I hypothesized that members of certain national cultural elites, what Kristol has called the new class, are becoming more powerful in American society, and that these elites or leadership groups are engaged in a sustained critique of that society. Many of those who are members of these elite groups are what I call liberal cosmopolitans. Their alienation from American society is primarily personal and social rather than economic. They dislike bourgeois emphases on restraint, achievement, and mundane matter-of-factness. Unlike the business strata, this is all hypothesis I'm giving you now, remember, which are achievement and rationality-oriented, the cultural elites are characterized by strong power needs. They are also marked by what psychoanalysts call narcissistic deficits and are therefore less capable than the business classes of genuine concern for others. They seek to create a society which caters to their needs. These cultural elites are drawn disproportionately from the middle and upper middle class, primarily in the Northeast Corridor and the West Coast, and have been partly educated in their new sensibilities at elite colleges and universities. They are either hostile or indifferent to religious values. As a result of technological change and the decline of more traditional institutions, cultural elites exercise an influence on society far greater than they once did, and are, in fact, helping to remake American society in their own image. Now, these are rather raunchy hypotheses. How does one go about testing them? The first step is to examine the social background, social, political attitudes, and personalities of the various groups with which we are concerned. My colleagues and I have just about completed this part of our study. We have administered a fairly complex questionnaire to most of the major elites in the country, including the executives of leading corporations, journalists working for the leading national media outlets, military leaders, corporate lawyers, top-level bureaucrats, religious leaders, producers, directors, and writers of primetime television shows, producers, writers, and directors of top-grossing motion pictures, and many others. And I'm going to speak only about one small part of the study, that is comparing the national media elite with corporate leaders, or the corporate elite, if you wish, to be balanced. Many of you are probably familiar with at least some of our results. As we anticipated, leading journalists are more likely than businessmen to come from well-educated, high-status professional families. Among the journalist fathers, 2 in 5 were professionals, and an equal number were businessmen. By contrast, only 1 in 5 businessmen came from professional homes, and the largest proportion, 28%, came from blue-collar backgrounds. Only 12% of the journalists we interviewed come from working-class backgrounds. The social and political orientations of journalists are well to the left of businessmen. 50% of the journalists report no religious affiliation compared to 12% of businessmen. Only 1 out of 7 media leaders attend church at least once a month, while a majority of businessmen are regular churchgoers. Most media leaders are not socialists. Only 12% favor nationalizing large corporations. However, they strongly sympathize with the economic and social policies developed by the new politics elements in the Democratic Party during the 1960s. They are also suspicious of and hostile to businessmen, and are more critical of American institutions than our businessmen. Finally, they are much more sympathetic than our businessmen to the new morality which developed during that period. For example, 88% of journalists, compared to 65% of businessmen, believe that the U.S. legal system favors the wealthy. 48% of media personnel believe that government should guarantee jobs to all, as compared to 29% of businessmen. The largest differences between the two groups, however, are to be found in their views on sexual morality and their perceptions of America's world role. 53% of journalists we interviewed, as compared to 24% of businessmen, believe that adultery is not wrong. And 56% of journalists, as compared to 22% of businessmen, believe that the United States is at least partly responsible for third world poverty. And many other results, which obviously I can't give you here. To measure the attitudes of businessmen and journalists toward each other, we asked those we interviewed to evaluate the social and political influence of various groups in American society on a 7-point scale. We then asked them to indicate how much influence they would prefer these groups to have. Businessmen and journalists each rated each other as having more influence than any other group in American society. As one might expect, businessmen believe that they are entitled to more influence and that journalists should have less. The views of journalists are exactly the opposite. Indeed, they would lower the influence of businessmen to just about the bottom of the scale. You probably won't be surprised to know that journalists at the New York Times and Washington Post are far more liberal than those at U.S. News and World Report. For example, 21% of the New York Times staffers believe that large corporations should be nationalized, while only 14% of the staffers of the Washington Post staffers express similar views. Some 70% of them believe that the United States is partly responsible for third world poverty, as do 65% of television journalists. Indeed, television producers and news commentators are perhaps the most liberal group in our sample, especially public television producers and commentators of news programs. Our evidence indicates that the upcoming generation of elite journalists may be even more liberal and cosmopolitan than the present generation, though our findings must be used with caution. We interviewed a sample of journalism students from the Columbia School of Journalism and found that some 40% would nationalize large corporations, 71% believe that the very structure of our society causes alienation, and 75% believe that the United States contributes to the poverty of third world nations. What about the personality differences? This is the raunchy part. We expected to find between journalists and businessmen. To measure these, we administered a personality test called the Thematic Apperception Test, or TAT. The test consists of several pictures, which can be interpreted in many different ways. For example, one picture shows an older man talking to a younger man in an office. The older man could be comforting the younger man, giving him advice, or criticizing him. Those interviewed are asked to write an imaginative story about the people in the picture, discussing what has led up to the situation shown, what the characters are thinking, what each one wants, what will happen, and so forth. The underlying assumption of the TAT, like the Rorschach inkblot test, is that when people use their imaginations in this way, they inadvertently tell us what is really on their minds. That is, their stories say a good deal about their needs and motivations, they will not even admit to themselves consciously. Psychologists have developed a fairly objective scoring system for the TAT, which indicate the presence of specific needs and motives, or scoring systems, I should say. For example, people with a strong need to achieve tend to write stories about characters who strive to attain a self-chosen standard of excellence. On the other hand, people with strong power needs write stories about characters who try to control or influence others. A large number of studies over a 30-year period indicate that people do behave in a manner consistent with their TAT scores. Thus, people who write power-oriented stories tend to be argumentative and assertive in their personal relations and to be power seekers. On the other hand, college students who write achievement-oriented stories tend to become successful managers and entrepreneurs. They've been followed over a period of 25, 30 years now. Our TATs were scored for a number of motives, including the needs for power and achievement, the fear of power, narcissism, and the capacity for intimacy. People who score high in the fear of power are ambivalent about their own desire for power. They want power, but are afraid to seek it directly. They often resolve this conflict by attacking people whom they perceive of as powerful. Thus, they can feel powerful without having to expose themselves to possible attack. And incidentally, we have empirical confirmation that these kinds of that these scores are correlated with this. This is not sort of made up in my own mind. Narcissism, as we use it, means self-absorption born of personal insecurity. The narcissist attempts to build himself or herself up by devaluing others. The capacity for intimacy, by contrast, measures the ability to develop warm, egalitarian relationships with others. All of the TATs were scored according to fairly rigid criteria by trained personnel who knew nothing about the study or its participants. The results were quite striking. The media elite scored significantly higher than the business elite in power motivation, fear of power, and narcissism. Businessmen displayed higher achievement motivation and a greater capacity for intimacy. Thus, compared to business leaders, journalists are narcissistic and power-oriented, while lacking concerns for achievement and the capacity for warm personal relationships. Wait till I tell you the differences between men and women. If anyone asks me, I will. I must point out that these are only statistical differences of degree. Our data does not allow one to conclude that journalists are completely lacking in achievement motivation, for example. They are, on the whole, simply less motivated by achievement needs than our businessmen. Further, there are obviously a great many exceptions. I'm giving averages. I am sure, for example, that every journalist attending this conference is highly achievement-oriented and has considerable capacity for intimacy.
Men or women?
Both. In all, the results would seem to confirm our hypothesis that elite journalists are liberal cosmopolitans in ideology and personality structure. They are ideological and personal rebels against bourgeois society. Do these attitudes and personal attributes affect the way in which journalists perceive and report on reality? I am not talking about intentional distortion. I think too much of the talk on this area has assumed that people lie and cheat consciously. Reality is very complex and often ambiguous. With the strongest desire to be objective, we are all bound to trust some people more than others and some perceptions more than others in an ambiguous world. Informed common sense, then, would suggest that however objective journalists may attempt to be, the kinds of persons they are must of necessity influence the manner in which they view and report on the world to some degree at least. There must be some slippage. Indeed, the very idea, after all, of a free press is predicated on the notion that people's ideologies and personalities do affect the manner in which they see and describe the world. Otherwise, all we would need is one objective national newspaper, like, for example, Pravda. It seems clear to me that the burden of proof lies with those who argue that journalists' views and personalities do not influence their reporting. Of course, most journalists disagree with me. They would argue that their training leads them to be objective, whatever their personal preferences. The editors of the very liberal Columbia Journalism Review criticized our study on just those grounds. They said that we lacked understanding of the manner in which journalists are trained and work. Actually, we have just about completed a content analysis of articles in the Columbia Journalism Review, which we started long before they criticized us. Just the academic wheels grind very slow. And we hope to publish this in the near future. It turns out that the editors actually agree with us, believe it or not, that despite their criticism, they differ only in that they believe reporters are fundamentally quite conservative and that such conservatism leads reporters to tailor their news to support the status quo. If you read their news, if you read their stories, any of you who are subscribers will understand what I'm talking about. I have statistics now and a coding scheme which is public and can be examined and so forth. I must say that most academic studies of news reporting suggest that journalists of somewhat negativistic do not let their views seriously interfere with coverage. My position is a minority one. I think that many conventional academic studies probably tell us more, frankly, about the ideologies of most of the academics who study journalists than they do about reality. However, the results of these studies are also a function of the way in which most of them are done. For the most part, academic studies of media content are involved relatively narrow political issues such as election campaigns, where it is relatively easy to be fair. I will, by and large, accept the finding by some that journalists were reasonably fair to various candidates in the 1980 election. We have chosen a rather different strategy, taking on the burden of proof. We have taken a series of social and political issues and are working on very rigorous statistical analyses of journalists' treatment of such issues in the elite media over a 10-year period. This is very complex, time-consuming, and expensive, and our ability to complete it will depend on our ability to continue to obtain adequate funding. Thus far, we have some initial results in two areas, that is, nuclear energy and busing to achieve integration. It is fairly clear in the first case that journalists have not accurately reported the views of the scientific community. They have, in fact, given far more credence to the relatively small group of scientists who oppose the development of nuclear energy than they have to the vast majority of scientists who are supportive of it. I've documented that. We have. Thus, the public's perception of the attitudes of the scientific community on this issue is quite distorted. It is also clear that journalists have reported on busing in such a way as to leave the impression that it is right and good, that they ignored the fears of parents about violence in ghetto schools in their coverage, and that until the late 1970s, they ignored the reality of white flight. And we can document that, too. Incidentally, my colleagues and I are also engaged in an unprecedented study of social and political themes in primetime television drama from the 1950s to date. And that's a big one. And hope to do the same with a sample of top-grossing motion pictures for the same period. Again, our ability to complete this very complex, time-consuming, and expensive project will depend on funding, but our preliminary findings, which some of you may have read, indicate that an anti-bourgeois bias is even more characteristic of these media outlets than it is of news reporting. Also, we have some evidence, going back to the news media, of another kind about the objectivity of journalists, which, while not definitive, supports our hypotheses. In our questionnaire, we asked journalists to summarize in a line or two a series of news stories which we had written about controversial issues. We gave him both sides. We found that on such issues as affirmative action, the black-white economic gap, and treatment of oil companies, reporters tended to emphasize one side, the liberal cosmopolitan side, in their summaries. We asked them to summarize a story in one line. We also coded the TAT pictures which we had used to tap reporters' motivations. We used them for to examine political and social content, developing a new code book. Not surprisingly, reporter stories about such pictures were, again, liberal cosmopolitan, as we call it. For example, businessmen in the stories they wrote, were with some frequency depicted as either thieves or fools. We now ask the final question. And I speak quickly, so I don't have to get the time. The final question is, of course, assuming that reporters incorporate their ideologies and their personality preferences in the manner in which they perceive and report on reality, what effect does this have? Again, informed common sense would suggest that in the long run, the effect is not insignificant. That's an academic phrase, not insignificant. Especially about matters such as nuclear energy, where ordinary citizens have no immediate feedback in their personal experience, but in other areas as well. Of course, media effect is the most difficult question of all to study in any reasonable way. There are a few studies which are suggestive. Some scholars have found a correlation between reliance on television news and political alienation. Others have found that people who read newspapers highly critical of American institutions tend themselves to be highly critical. And those of you who read the book know that Schneider and Lipset, in a book called The Confidence Gap, have presented some evidence which indicates that the public's loss of faith in American institutions may be at least partly related to the manner in which journalists report the news, in quotes. However, there are so many factors operating at the same time that it's hard to be sure, or to measure, in fact, with any precision, what role the media plays. More and more Americans attend colleges and universities where they are taught, by and large, by liberal cosmopolitan academics. They read books written by authors with the same views, and they attend movies or watch television shows which have a similar perspective. Beyond this, affluence, scientific and technological change, the development of more effective contraceptive techniques, the emergence of the race issue, and a whole host of other factors have undoubtedly influenced Americans and citizens in other countries, including journalists themselves. Finally, many have argued that capitalism has a tendency to self-destruct by promoting values, perceptions, and groups which are inimical to its own survival. And this goes back to Schumpeter, to Dan Bell, to a certain extent, to Irving Kristol. The issues are very complex, and it would take me far longer, it's going to take a whole book of 300 or 400 pages one of these days, to explore. I don't have the time here. In my own view, larger forces are in operation which help explain some of the things that have been happening in the past 3 or 4 decades, and which are eroding the traditional values of this society. However, there's no question in my mind but that the intellectual strata, broadly defined, has been influential in their process, in this process. Their role, of course, has been accentuated by the communications revolution and the decline of traditional institutions such as religion. I mean the emergence of television and therefore the ability to create a national media network of a certain kind. Today, ideas, perceptions, and values move quite rapidly from the media to a larger public. Indeed, I am persuaded that if we compare journalists and businessmen 10 years ago, the gap between their beliefs would have been rather larger than the gap we actually found. That is, I think the influence of the media is so pervasive in our society that ideas get introduced in the media and, at least in some cases, move very rapidly to other segments of the population, very quickly, where once these other segments of the population were isolated, when they lived in ethnic ghettos or other institutions were strong, now, in many areas, especially those not closely related to personal experience, the impact of the media, broadly defined, to include, incidentally, motion pictures, television, and so forth, is much more rapid, so that you try to find out the media's influence by examining the gap between the media and the public, you know, at one point in time, you may get a distorted picture. In any event, I conclude that the media elite in this country stands at the cutting edge of a new social, cultural, and psychological sensibility, and that journalists have played an important role in the willingness of other Americans to begin to adopt this sensibility as their own. Thank you.
Will you take a few questions?
My pleasure.
That,
can you go back up there? Or
why don't you? Laurie? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, David McClelland, whose measures we're using, defined achievement empirically as the attempt to reach a self-defined standard of excellence. That it's an attempt to accomplish something with, whether it be run a race faster, but the competition is with the self. The ultimate concern, don't get me wrong now, I'm comparing media and business personnel so far. We'll have data on all our groups eventually. We have no national public standards. I'm just comparing two groups. But seeking, now, this isn't that businessmen aren't power-oriented, don't get me wrong. They have power scores, and we'll find out how they can. So are professors, I'm told, by other people who study them. But it's a question of, you know, the relevant motives. We all have power drives. We all have some achievement orientation, and so forth and so on. But McClelland differentiates these, and I think quite legitimately. I'm not saying seeking power is a bad thing, incidentally, either, necessarily. When it gets extreme, it is. Yes? Well, unfortunately, one wishes one could do with the studies again. Now, we don't have the kind of information we'd like. We do have a little bit, and we haven't coded all of it. One thing we did ask them is where they would turn to information on certain topics. Later questionnaires for other groups, we asked more other interesting questions. And one thing we did find out, and we made it some mistake, one thing we did find out, this was the media and business elites were studied during the Carter administration. And we found that whereas businessmen on areas, say, of environmental pollution, if they wanted to get information, would turn to certain sources like I can't remember now, but Business or Scientific Journals or Friends or something. The journalist said Ralph Nader or the EPA and so forth and so on. That is, the groups they turn to for information, for expertise on issues of that kind, are partly determined by the views they hold. Now, the problem is which comes first, the chicken or the egg? It's a question, for example, as to whether media people are liberal when they get into journalism. I mean, similar question. Or are they made liberal by living in New York, especially with television and being journalists? Well, every study shows that people who go into business administration, major in business administration as undergraduates, are more conservative than people who major in the social sciences or say they're going to go into journalism. So they start out with certain proclivities already. Then, of course, mixing with other people of similar kinds of proclivities and forming their little universe, they just strengthen these things. And some conservatives who do come in, I think, tend to be swept up by the milieu as well. So, you know, how these things interact with each other is very difficult, and I have no complete answers. Well, yeah, one way is to write articles. And no, I'm serious. I think that people, look, you'll never convince everybody. I mean, the other way is force. You know. But you'll never convince everybody because there are people who are so rigid that they simply don't change. However, there is an undetermined number of people who are swept up by these things because no one opposes them. They're part of a milieu. They get this kind of information. It's a very slow, difficult process, but you can get to these people. I mean, ideas are changed by other ideas. They have historically been. It's not an easy road, I think. I'm not awfully optimistic, frankly. I just, my own effect on students is a few students, after a semester, may begin to think a little differently. Should I recognize people? Please.
What was the difference between men and women?
Well, all right, you really want to know?
Yes, I do.
All right, the difference is as follows. First of all, women tend to be more liberal, quote, than men on every issue, within business or within the media, okay? That is, business women are almost as liberal as male journalists. Female journalists are most liberal of all on that. So that's not at all surprising. Female business women don't believe in nationalization and things like that, but on social issues they are more liberal. Now, why that's so is an interesting question. I shan't try to answer it at the moment unless you press me further. The personality things were quite interesting, and I won't go into the debate within the feminist movement, which make them interesting. But in fact, if you take a look at the successful business women, and these are successful business women, as compare them to men, in fact, the business women score the same on achievement motivation as men, but they score lower on power than men, lower on fear of power than men, higher on capacity for intimacy, as business women as against businessmen, and higher also on something I didn't measure because the differences weren't significant between the groups as a whole, higher on the need for affiliation, desire for personal relationships and friendliness. So it does seem from our study as if business women achieve success using a different strategy than businessmen, more emphasis on personal relationships than on power-oriented relationships. On the other hand, if you compare women journalists to male journalists, they look about the same. So that the differences between female journalists and business women are greater than the differences between male journalists and businessmen. And that's it. I found that fascinating. I don't know what to do with it yet. But it'll come out in an article, even though I don't. I mean, I always publish, yeah.
the line we're used to hearing from the media when they are criticized is that the messenger shouldn't be shot to bring the bad news. You may have heard that once or twice.
Yes, more than that.
Since that this is the only messenger that has the discretion of deciding which messages to deliver and which to tear up, the most interesting data of all your very interesting studies to me is the data that most of the media elite see their role as promoting social change. They don't see themselves as having a merely neutral role. Could you expand on that?
Well, look, sure. Now, I must tell you that on our findings, media people don't look as nice as businessmen as persons. But we don't have to deal with that kind of issue. I'd rather deal with another issue. I think that media people think as follows. Yes, we will promote social reform by telling the truth. You know, that the truth shall make you free. I think most of them do not consciously lie, do not consciously deceive. They actually believe what they say. And they believe that, as we believe here, that by getting people to know the truth, that will promote good ends. So I don't think they see any contradiction, for the most part, there are some who do, between their seeking social reform and being objective. Like when they, for example, report things on busing and so forth and so on, they seem to mean, as Walter Cronkite said, we're for the people and against authority. That's obvious any good person is. That's their view. And the trouble is, who are the people and what's authority and so on and so on. So I think the issue here is that they define the good in some ways, and they don't see it as an ideological definition, one way of looking at the world, which may be correct or incorrect. It is reality. And that's the problem. And they talk to each other, they associate with each other, they slap each other. We're all prone to that to some extent. Since they're a majority now in certain communities, as at universities or elsewhere, they don't have to listen to other voices, and they can shut them off if they want. That's the real issue is not the guys and the bad, you know, the bad guys versus the good guys. It's a much more difficult and complex issue. If we knew who wore the black hats or the blue hats these days, I suppose, it would be much easier in this world. It's much harder than that, unfortunately. Yes?
How it influences. I want to know your comparison and how you think businessmen compare peer group pressure influences.
I don't have any data on that. Sorry, it's nothing we studied. I'm just let me think. We asked them incidentally what the politics were of their colleagues around them, and most journalists thought that the politics of their colleagues was to the left of theirs. A businessman, I don't remember the answer, but it's very hard to measure something like peer group influence. I assume it does exist to a very considerable extent. I've been influenced by my peers. You get older, you're influenced less because you get more stubborn and obstinate. But as a younger person, I certainly was influenced by the milieu in which I grew up. It took me a long time to get out of it. I grew up and went to CCNY, and it took me a long time to realize there was another way of looking at the world and that maybe I hadn't always seen the truth as a young man. Yes? Oh dear, I'm not quite sure. I mean, I'm not quite sure what you're asking me, to be honest. I mean, people do deceive themselves.
Yeah.
The question is, I guess you asked me, can I measure that?
Yeah.
No way that I know of. I mean, it'd be interesting.
I'm just curious.
No, I have. We've thought of a lot of clever things, but we haven't come up with one to measure that. There are so many things. Once you commit yourself to measurement, unfortunately, there are a lot of things that's very hard to study in any reasonable, find empirical evidence for. You can only try. Use common sense as best you can. I mean, I know a lot of people who deceive themselves a lot, but I have no way of measuring that. Yes, please.